This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital, Part 4, The Depth of the Assault on Working People. Already, 1 million homes across the country have been seized by banks and other financial institutions providing mortgages. But that is only the tip of the iceberg. Repossessions rose 90% last month, according to RealtyTrack, a company that tracks foreclosure statistics. 8,000 families a day are sliding into foreclosures. 233,000 properties are in some stage of default. This would mean almost 3 million more homes lost in the coming year. According to analysts at Citigroup, about $460 billion worth of adjustable mortgages are scheduled to reset this year. That is, the interest each month of the mortgage will rise drastically. This raises the minimum payments for borrowers. What is the significance for people across the United States? What really is happening? Today on Taking Aim, we will discuss the depth of the assault on working people. Ralph?
Maya, January was the sixth straight month with over 200,000 foreclosure filings, according to RealtyTrack. The fourth quarter total of 642,150 filings was the most since records were recorded. More than 1% of U.S. households are in stages of foreclosure. That's in, just in 2007, and this is escalating on a very rapid scale. So this crisis is not merely uncontained by the bailout of Bear Stearns, so-called, but it is, in fact, escalating by every standard. And the impact on working people is only beginning to be measured in its true magnitude.
Let's look at the statistics. Bloomberg.com, that is gives financial reporting, discusses how the crisis is continuing. In an article by Sharon Lynch, U.S. home foreclosures jumped 90% as mortgages reset, statistics that I mentioned in our introduction. State housing agencies, however, are turning away many applicants, applications for assistance with their mortgages, because their homes have lost too much value or the people have accumulated too much debt. This is significant because home prices in 20 U.S. metropolitan areas fell in December by the most on record, the most since statistics have been kept. The measure dropped 9.1% from a year earlier. Nationwide, home prices fell 8.9% in the fourth quarter from a year earlier, the biggest decline in 20 years. According to some financial analysts, with the collapse of housing values, many homeowners realize there's no chance that they will ever be a true owner of their home. In other words, no matter how much they pay with rising interest each month, they're never going to attack the principal. And consequently, they are just handing the keys back to the bank. California and Florida recorded the highest foreclosure rates among the 50 states. California in itself represents 13% of the gross national product of the United States. It's a very significant part of the U.S. economy. So when California and Florida record the highest foreclosure rates, the country is sliding into a very deep recession. Some call it an epic recession. What are the numbers in California? 57,158 properties facing possible seizure just in the beginning of this year. But it isn't limited to California. Florida had the second highest number of homes in default or foreclosure. 30,178 families facing assault and dispossession in January alone. This is double the figure from last year. Arizona, Colorado, Massachusetts, Georgia, Connecticut, Ohio, and Michigan round out the top 10 states in the situations of missed payments. Ralph?
Well, Maya, if you measure this in terms of locales, New York is one of the real signals of what's going on. Here's a piece in the New York Times on March 24th. With the economy tied to Wall Street, New York braces for job cuts, Louise Story's article, which makes a very important point. Namely, as she puts it, the New York economy is more dependent than ever on high Wall Street incomes, which had jumped by more than half since 2001. Now the city braces for a huge contraction in the financial sector as a result of the credit crisis and the collapse of Bear Stearns, and the fallout will be far worse than in the past. The finance industry was responsible for a third of all wages in New York City, and this is the highest ratio in recorded times. Each Wall Street job supports three workers in other sectors of the New York economy. So the consequence of this is that as the credit crisis unfolded and firms discovered the depth of their losses, layoffs are going to escalate on a scale that has been unprecedented, and the impact across New York will be absolutely catastrophic, as the article sets it out.
And, Ralph, what you mean by credit crisis is the speculative crisis. In other words, as the financial institutions, particularly the investment banks, are having to borrow money to cover the margins on their speculative investments, their hedge funds, and their buying of derivative instruments. Other banks don't want to lend them money. That created a credit crunch. And also there's the credit crunch of the foreclosed homes that we were speaking about. So this is what you mean, the speculative crisis that is taking place and unfolding in the United States. Go on about New York, Ralph.
Well, the basic point that's being made here, as she puts it in her article, Bear was a profound shock to the market. No one could have fathomed that something like this would happen so fast. Employees across the board in New York are nervous. Anxiety is felt among all the businesses that cater to Wall Street, the president of the food delivery systems. All of the financial markets are tied to, because of the extent to which the fictive economy is dominant in American capitalisms, the job losses that flow from the collapse of the financial sector will be on a scale with the crisis for these banking and financial conglomerates themselves.
Well, Ralph, she's specific. Since August, the financial industry has shed at least 20,000 jobs, mostly among those selling loans, bundling loans into the complex security instruments, and those placing trading bets on the likelihood that borrowers would pay. That's, again, the speculative gambling that is so rampant with these financial institutions. Now the pace of job losses is increasing. Besides the 14,000 at Bear Stearns that probably will be cut, Citigroup is in the process of cutting 10% of its workforce in its investment bank. Lehman Brothers announced 1,400 layoffs. Goldman Sachs has reduced its global workforce by 5% and has announced that it was going to increase that to 20%, or 6,400 jobs. And it goes on from there. Ralph?
The World Socialist website has a synopsis of this phenomenon on April 5th, a piece by David Walsh, which is quite summary. U.S. jobless figures, the specter of a new depression. The Friday Labor Department report, the article discloses, revealing that payrolls were cut by 80,000 jobs in March and 232,000 further jobs lost in 3 months, means new levels of social misery and raises the specter of an economic slump whose severity will be the deepest since the Great Depression. The March decline in jobs is the largest in 5 years. Private sector jobs dropped 300,000. Millions of Americans face the prospect of sharp and dramatic decline in its living standards and conditions of life. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics survey is equally bleak. The jobless rose by 434,000 in March to 7.8 million. The unemployment rate rose from 4.8 to 5.1%. Those are official numbers. The actual numbers are much larger because, as we've often pointed out, as soon as someone ceases to look for work after, let's say, three times to the unemployment exchange because no work is available, they're no longer counted as amongst the unemployed.
And, Ralph, that is why the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which counts the number of people not working, is much higher than the Labor Department, because the Labor Department only gives the figures of those still looking for work, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics gives the figure of those who are not working at all. And even that figure, the BLS figure, is an underestimate, because many people who do work have precarious part-time work, which doesn't meet the living standard that they need to fulfill daily life here in the United States.
Well, Moody's economist Mark Zandi called it a broad-based decline. And that, and he indicated that, quote, the problem isn't just housing or Wall Street. The problems are now affecting the rest of the economy with equally catastrophic results, as Sandy articulated this in the Los Angeles Times. Construction is hit dramatically. 51,000 jobs lost in March. 42,000 jobs down from trade contractors. Manufacturing jobs fell 48,000 in March, which is the largest drop in 2 years. 310,000 lost in 12 months. Every facet of the real-world economy is in escalating decline. Jobs and employment services fell by 42,000 in March and decreased by 210,000 jobs. The March employment figures were worse than analysts had predicted. They are, as the chief economist for Wachovia, John Silver, put it in CNNMoney.com, "If we had known it was anything like this, there would be no debate about whether we are in a recession. This is pretty stark." And indeed, Ian Shepherdson of High Frequency Economics put it like this: "These overall numbers are significantly worse. Trends are awful. Unemployment will keep rising dramatically, squeezing spending, which in effect has an escalator effect on the entire economy. The government's jobless rate is notoriously underestimates the actual number of people out of work," the World Socialist website points out. In fact, the BLS report states the total unemployed rate, including working part-time involuntarily, as you indicated, Maya, is at 9.1% in March 2008. 13.9 million people, up from 8 million a year earlier, have been thrown out of work. So these real numbers are multiples greater than the official statistics. Now, what about the effect on the population of the price escalation for staples? Flour and milk and eggs were up 24% for the year ending in February. Gasoline is escalating out of all reach. Associated Press economics writer Janine Aversa stated, "With energy and food prices, workers feel that their paychecks are shrinking to nothing. This, in fact, is the mass experience throughout the country, while the corporate CEOs are raking in vast fortunes on a scale equally unprecedented." And as the World Socialist website puts it rather neatly, "These geniuses who have proclaimed the wonders of the capitalist market preside over the present disaster, threatening widening layers of the population in the United States. It is the worst recession, quote unquote, since 1945, the assault on working people goes beyond the growth in joblessness and inflation. This perfect storm of an economic crisis means that the value of the only asset people possess, many people, their home, is dropping even as the job market shrinks and prices rise. And that's the real significance of this flood of mortgage foreclosures, which has risen to an all-time high, as the Mortgage Bankers Association revealed in its March 6th report. And therefore, the social consequences which follow are, as that economic report states, appalling. empty houses in terms of percentages are higher than at any time since 1956, and that's resulted in an epidemic of break-ins, stripping homes of pipes of copper and valuable metals. There is a scavenging for survival taking place amongst working people across the United States, which is a real measure of the magnitude of this catastrophe. Quote, in Cleveland, City Councilor Tony Brancatelli explained, we are seeing houses packaged and sold for $100 a piece. Investor speculators are swooping down and grabbing the homes that working people are losing and packaging them in multiples of 100 and even 1,000, and they're buying them for $100 a piece as they speculate on fortunes to be made at the expense of working people. And meanwhile, the U.S. Treasury is being drained of multiple trillions to maintain the wars that are killing and maiming yet larger numbers of American soldiers and, of course, the millions in Iraq and Afghanistan,
Ralph,
who are the sacrificial lambs to this ruthless system.
Ralph, we should point out that these homes that are being sold for $100 are not homes that are available to you or me. These are homes that have been ransacked and they're being actually recycled. They're being torn down and stripped of materials and repackaged at a time when they could be fixed up, and people who are homeless or people who need homes at low cost could be purchasing these homes. But that's not what's happening. In other words, they are eliminating the housing stock. Let's look at the auto industry as an example. In just March alone, 24,000 jobs were lost in the auto industry, and the rate has been 6,000 jobs per month. And let's look at particular at one company, American Axle, where there has been a 6-week strike. And it is a strike of valiant workers at American Axle. And in many ways, they're defying the UAW, the Auto Workers Union. And
which is our union. Maya and I have been in the UAW for a very long period of time, at least 20 years, because we're in the National Writers Union, which is part of the UAW. So we've been active in the rank and file movement of the UAW, and we know firsthand what these struggles are about.
And the American Axle is very interesting because as there have been cutbacks at American Axle, the CEO has had a huge, huge hundreds of millions of dollars of perks awarded to them. And it's a very interesting case because over the past 3 decades, the unions have been transformed themselves. Instead of being instruments for defending the interests of working people, they have been imposing concessions and forming allegiances with the corporations, whether sitting on the board, as in the instance of Chrysler during the bailout, or in the case now of the sellout of the unions taking over the health care plans for retirees. The UAW has taken on the stocks of the auto workers. That means the UAW is in a position where it must maintain the stock prices of the auto industry in order to maintain the extremely large health care fund, the VEBA, it's called, for the auto workers. And the UAW has lost 73,500 members in 2007 alone. This is an incredible drop in the auto industry, a widespread buyout of workers in Detroit's 3 auto makers and the suppliers in the last couple of years as they're giving options to the longtime workers in the auto industry to take some money in order to retire. An important article in the Detroit News about the loss of the 73,500 members in 2007 The ranks hit the lowest level since 1941. This is an article that appeared March 29, 2008, with the union's membership declining 13.7% from 2006. That's an incredible loss. 237,000 members. That means fewer auto workers in both the auto industry and the suppliers since the end of 2001. Incredible.
Well, Maya, I think we have to look at this very specifically and concretely. The president of United Auto Workers called for real sacrifices on the part of his rank and file, American Axle workers. And that strike by 3,600 workers at American Axle exposes the unbridgeable chasm that separates rank and file workers from the leadership of the UAW, as it does most of the bureaucratized unions in the United States. Listen to this op-ed piece by UAW International President Ron Gettelfinker, which was published in the Detroit News on the 4th. It says very clearly and identifies, I think, explicitly the position of the union hierarchy in this important industrial strike, which is now in its 7th week. Gettelfinker recounts the concessions that the United Auto Workers under his leadership have repeatedly granted the company. Quote, "This year, we again put forward our responsible proposals to address American Axle's legitimate concerns. These proposals will mean real sacrifices for our membership and real material savings for the company." Unquote. So the president of the UAW has acknowledged that he has reached a basic agreement with American Axle over the company's demands for steep cuts in labor costs. What he's doing is stating that he has made every concession that could be asked of him, including accepting huge bonuses for the top executives in the middle of the strike. And he writes, "Our members understand the competitive realities of the auto industry. That's why we've given American Axle a break in 2004 and 2006. We slashed the company's labor costs by $200 million a year." So concession after concession, embracing the profit incentive and necessity of the top executives of American Axle.
And, Ralph, this is meant... What American Axle is trying to force the workers to do is to accept a 50% cut in their wages. Can you imagine a 50% cut?
A 50% cut in wages, and that's only the beginning of it, because they're accepting as well the laying off of whole sectors of people in the immediate aftermath of the signing of this deal. And union and management are able to push through previous concessions by blackmailing the workers with the threat of plant closings and mass layoffs, which no sooner were the concessions made, occurred anyway. The UAW collaborated with management to coerce workers into taking the buyout, according to the National Labor Relations Board complaint of Local 424, which was filed by the workers at the shutdown Buffalo, New York plant. The workers filed a complaint because no sooner did they make the concessions when the plant was shut down anyway.
Yes, Ralph, because look at the concessions that were made already with American Axle. And once the concessions were made, American Axle closed down plants in Detroit, Three Rivers, Michigan, and the New York towns of Tonawanda and Cheektowaga. And along with the concession that they're looking for with the wage cut from $28.15 an hour to $14.50 an hour, and in some cases as low as $11.50 an hour, American Axle is also seeking a sharp reduction in health coverage, the elimination of employer-paid pensions, and the destruction of at least 1,000 more jobs. Now, this is just an example of one company, American Axle, in the auto industry, and the auto industry is a bulwark of the American manufacturing sector. We should also look at what is happening to people as these jobs are lost.
Well, I would like to amplify for a brief moment what the implications of this, because this is a core strike. It's an extended strike in which the rank and file are in battle mode, and the UAW leadership is maneuvering to destroy the strike of its own rank and file. The Gettelfinger editorial came amidst a flurry of activity by the UAA international bureaucracy aimed at strangling the strike. The UAW announced that the company had been handing over data requested by the union on its labor costs following a meeting between the UAW international and local representatives, and in fact what the leadership stated was that having obtained these labor costs, they would now concede that they had to cut these labor costs on behalf of the bosses in order to enable the plant to be competitive. What that means is that the union bureaucracy is taking on the profit concerns of the bosses and allowing each company to sandbag workers by pitting them against each other, company by company. If you don't make concessions to those who have already obtained the greatest concessions in other plants, then you will be deemed non-competitive. It's a mad race to the bottom with the union bureaucracy colluding. As the UAW president declared after the 10-day strike notification at five GM plants in Michigan, Ohio, and Texas had been called, we would like nothing better to cancel our rally because the strike was resolved. And then the union offered major wage and benefit cuts in order to obtain that result, well aware that the militant opposition of its rank-and-file workers was building to a point where any concession contract would be very likely overturned. Here is how the matter resolves. The UAW used to fight big business. Now it is a big business because, as you mentioned earlier, Maya, the hard-won gains of generations of auto workers from the big three negotiations have been translated into investments in the stock of Ford and GM and Dana Corporation, which means that the union bureaucrats lose money if the stock falls. So they have a material stake in handing more concessions, increasing the value of the stock, so that the rank-and-file workers are sacrificed on the altar of greater profitability for the company in which the union bureaucracy has an ample share.
But, Ralph, also the health benefits of the retirees and the union workers, the current workers, are tied to the stocks of these auto companies because no longer are the companies responsible for providing the health benefits. These health benefits are being provided by the union itself. And unlike the strike fund, the United Auto Workers strike fund of over $1 billion, this mammoth strike fund, which they barely ever tap into because they only pay strike benefits of $200 a week to the striking workers, this strike fund is invested in U.S. treasuries, the propping up the U.S. government. But the other investments of the UAW, and such as this VEBA, they are in the companies, the capitalist companies themselves.
They're in the Dana Corporation, they're in Ford, they're in GM, and consequently there's a growing recognition amongst workers that they cannot defend their interests through the UAW and its leadership, that they have to find a new road to struggle. As one of the leaders of the strike said, the UAW used to fight big business, now they are a big business. And as a result, membership in the UAW has fallen to the lowest point since 1941, which highlights the following, brothers and sisters. New industrial organizations of the working class will have to be built in opposition to the corporatist unions. American axle workers are spearheading a fight. They need to elect rank-and-file committees led by trusted militants. They have to take control of the conduct of the struggle out of the hands of the bureaucracy. They need rank-and-file committees who will appeal to all auto workers to spread the strike, to overturn the wage-cutting contracts. A new political strategy is needed to unite this working class against the impact of the financial crisis, the home foreclosures, the layoffs, the assault on living standards. That requires breaking with the Republicans and Democrats and building a new political movement of the working class. Nothing short of that will address this crisis. That is the agency of change. That is the category of our population, the class that is under greatest assault. This is where the struggle is launched. This is where the struggle has to be sustained. And it means a new day for working class people. They're Leadership has to be from their ranks. They have to take control over their own affairs and conduct this struggle on the line and each day with a political dimension at heart of the very strike effort itself.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital, Part 4, The Depth of the Assault on Working People.
I want to just remind our listeners, Maya, that we're going to move on from the Axel strike. Can you imagine that the leader of a union with a rank and file engaged in strike is demanding that the workers accept a 50% cut in their wages, as you pointed out? Nothing so clearly highlights the stakes here.
New York Times, March 31st. As jobs vanish and prices rise, food stamp use nears record. This was such an important article that appeared in the New York Times that it was picked up in by newspapers around the world. Eric Eckholm. Driven by a painful mix of layoffs and rising food and fuel prices, the number of Americans receiving food stamps is projected to reach 28 million in the coming year, the highest level since the aid program began in the 1960s. Federal benefit costs are projected to rise $36 billion in 2009 fiscal year from $34 billion this year. An example is Michigan, the industrial heartland, the home of most of the auto factories, and we were just speaking about the implications for American Axle workers. In Michigan, one in eight residents now receives food stamps. Quote, our caseload has more than doubled since 2000. We're at an all-time record level, said Maureen Sorbet, spokeswoman for the Michigan Department of Human Services. But it's not limited to Michigan. Let's look at other states: Arizona, Florida, Maryland, Nevada, North Dakota, and Rhode Island. From December 2006 to December 2007, more than 40 states saw their recipient numbers rise. In Rhode Island, the number of recipients climbed by 18% over the last 2 years to more than 84,000. And in February, 8.4% of the population. This is the highest total in the last dozen years or more, said the state administrator of Family and Adult Services. New York, of which we were speaking before, began a program to promote enrollment of increased food stamp recipients during the last decade. But that alone isn't enough to explain the amazing increase in recipients. There's an additional 67,000 clients that were added between July 2007 and January of this year, so that 1.86 million people, or 1 in 10 New Yorkers, now receives food stamps. Ralph?
Well, Maya, as Stacy Dean, the director of food stamp policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, noted, people sign up for food stamps when they lose their jobs or their wages go down or their hours are cut. She noted that in 14 key states in this country, the food stamp rolls reached record numbers by last December. Now, what's significant about that is that these record numbers of people on food stamps because of the devastation of their jobs and their incomes preceded the collapse of Bear Stearns and the current crisis. And that's why we have in the independent in the United Kingdom on April 1st an article by David Usborne called USA 2008, The Great Depression. Food stamps are the symbol of poverty in the United States. In the era of the credit crunch, a record 28 million Americans are relying on food stamps to survive, a sure sign that the world's richest country faces the most profound economic crisis. And he writes, we knew things were bad on Wall Street, but on Main Street it is far worse. Startling official statistics show that as this new economic recession stalks the United States, a record number of Americans will be depending on food stamps just to feed themselves and their families. And he lays out the full magnitude of this crisis in city after city, country after country, 40 states reporting vast increase in applications for the stamps. And in fact, the electronic cards that are automatically filled out are swiped by shoppers at the till. There is an absolute stampede of crisis dependency on food stamps and a run on the food banks in city after city. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, people in this country are only beginning to register the magnitude of the capitalist crisis and its impact upon them.
Ralph, what you're referring to is food stamps are no longer coupons. They have debit cards. And as a result, there isn't the same stigma of collecting food stamps, of using them. Eligibility for food stamps is a complex formula, and it is a very difficult process now to get on food, to receive food stamps. The eligibility is few assets and income below 130% of the poverty line. That means $27,560 for a family of four, and the assets must be less than $2,000 in the bank. Households with income no higher than 185% of federal poverty level can get food and nutrition for their children through another program that's WIC, for Women, Infants, and Children. That's what WIC stands for, Women, Infants, and Children. And 8.5 million pregnant women and children through the age of four are on the WIC program.
Well,
this is an incredible statistic for the United States.
Yes, Maya. Eligibility for the food stamp program is complicated, as you indicate. Households must have no more than 130% of the federal poverty threshold in monthly income and no more than 100% of the poverty threshold. What does this translate
to?
Net income after taxes, yes. It amounts to a net income of less than $851 a month. For an individual, a single mother with two children would not qualify for food assistance if she has a net income of more than $360 a week. In other words, if you have an income of over $10,000 a year and you're a single mother with two children, forget it. You won't be getting to qualify for food stamps. Households must have no more than $2,000 in monetary resources total. Applicants have to provide financial records, pay stubs, medical stubs, receipts for rent and child care, proof of mortgage and utility payments, proof of vehicle worth, and official birth certificates and personal documents for every family member. That's why at least 40% of those who are eligible do not receive food stamps. They don't even know they qualify, or the process is so difficult. What this means, brothers and sisters, is that this increase in the food stamp rolls is the most conservative measure of the real number of working families exposed to precarious circumstances. Because as the New York Times noted in an article on March 31st, in the manufacturing strongholds, that is to say the ex and former manufacturing strongholds, Michigan, Ohio, and Illinois, the climb in food stamp recipients has been relentless through economic upturns and downturns because it reflects the total devastation of the industrial sector in the United States. The real economy is devastated. It's a fictive economy of finance, capital, and its speculation. And that is what is in collapse and in crisis. And it is precipitating an overall collapse of the capitalist economy in the United States.
Ralph, we were talking about the industrial heartland. In a place such as Kentucky and Appalachia in the South, one in seven residents currently rely on federal food assistance. And let's remind people that this food assistance is not enough to on which to survive, because recipients receive only $85 a month. And for most people, their allocation runs out in days or even weeks before the end of the month. The average family of four, it is calculated, in a moderate cost shopping plan would be spending $900 per month on groceries. So you can see here that the food stamps are not even a palliative. And people also rely on food banks where there's distribution of free food. But America's Second Harvest, which distributes 2 billion pounds of food in the U.S. each year, has reported that its client load rose 20% in just the fourth quarter of 2007. Yet its pantries are running short. It's the worst it's seen in 26 years. Part of the reason is that farmers are planting 8% less corn. Some of it is being, the land is being diverted for ethanol production. And the other reason is because of sending their corn for export. And then also Second Harvest relies on donations and charitable and emergency charitable donations from individuals and companies that are now defaulting and finding their own income declining is dropping. And so the fail-safe of these food banks for the distribution of free food is also falling. Ralph?
Let's look at some of the other parameters of this crisis. The high school dropout rate in major United States cities has reached 50%. 52% of public high school students in major cities, the 50 largest cities in the United States, failed to graduate. The national average is 70%. 1.2 million public high school students are dropping out every year. Overall high school graduation rates are lower in urban schools than in the suburbs, and these disparities in major cities exceed 25 percentage points. So what we're looking at here is a generalized crisis that then impacts the ability and youngsters, working class kids, to stay in school because they have to try to get work to survive, because the schools themselves are in total disarray. Their physical plant is deteriorating.
They have been defunded, Ralph. Basically, the schools, the inner city schools, have been defunded.
Well, as Colin Powell, hardly in the forefront of revolution, the former Secretary of State and the General Joint Chiefs of Staff, when more than a million students a year drop out of high school, this is more than a problem. This is a national catastrophe. That's Colin Powell in what can only be called an actual understatement, because in the cities where the graduation gap is the greatest, the so-called Rust Belt, where three decades of plant closures in key industries like auto and steel have had the most devastating impact, and in cities like New York and Philadelphia and Buffalo and Chicago and Cleveland and Detroit, where millions of jobs have been wiped out, where workers' wages and living standards have been gutted, where the social infrastructure of entire communities has been eliminated, the kids are no longer in school. The so-called No Child Left Behind represents not just left behind, but totally cut out from the process of education, from the process of employment, from the process of inclusion in a functioning society. While this is occurring, the richest 10% of the population holds 71% of household wealth. The bottom 80% of American households accounts for less than 15% of this household wealth. And in fact, 40% of households possess 0.2% of this national wealth. This is an ever-escalating crisis of assault upon living standards of working people.
And, Ralph, another aspect, aside from 50% of students not graduating, is an article that appeared that you found from the New York Sun on March 28th. U.S., are we really that ill? And at this point, we'll just discuss one of the most startling statistics, and that is that studies indicate that there are 200 million prescriptions written annually in America to treat depression and anxiety. That 67.5 million people across the United States are taking antidepressants. One half are described as mentally ill.
Half of the population of the United States is labeled as mentally ill. What does that mean?
Stress.
Stress. People's lives are being destroyed around them. Their prospects are nil. The stress is overwhelming, so they're called crazy. And they're given pills to pop while the world around them collapses. And then one quarter are on antidepressants. What is this but a measure of the assault upon the survival of working people as a class within the United States? Look at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, the data that shows the concentration of income. The average income for households in the top 1% has risen by over $73,000 per household, while it's plummeting for the bottom 90%. And this is what the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington concluded. Not since 1928, just before the Great Depression, has the top 1% held such a large share of the nation's income. The share of the nation's income flowing to the top 1% has escalated on a scale never seen before. And indeed, they had another startling statistic and conclusion. The top tenth of 1% of the have had the largest increase in income since 1928. The top tenth of 1% households have grown more rapidly than the incomes of the top 1% of households. So within this tiny and privileged ruling class, the differentiation is even more stark in that 0.1% is escalating in its grasp of the major factors of wealth in the United States. In three decades since 1976, the incomes of the bottom 90% of households has been plummeting, while the 1% and the 0.1% income has been soaring to unprecedented levels, greater than those that have been recorded in 32 years. And the data that is being assembled here emphasizes how the class war has reached proportions where the working class is at a point of virtual incapacity to function within organized society.
Ralph, this is highlighted by Jack Rasmus, a political scientist who focuses on labor issues. In a forthcoming article that will appear in Z Magazine in May of this year, Financial Crisis, Epic Recession, and Depression, he notes, quote, since at least the early 1980s, the 90 million middle and working class households earning less than $80,000 or so a year have not experienced real gains after inflation in real weekly earnings. Real earnings, that is, adjusted for inflation, for working class American families are less today than they were a quarter century ago in 1982. And this is according to government data. While families at the top ranges of the 80,000 have had some net gains in wage incomes, those in the middle have lost ground, and those of the millions of families below the median have lost significantly. The 25 million non-working class households, that is, people not working, earning above 80,000, have in contrast experienced significant net income gains. That's what you were talking about, the top 5% and the top 1% having realized the majority of the gains.
And the top 0.1%.
That's right, even more so. And Rasmus continues, working class consumption has continued to rise over the past several decades. Incidentally, it is now dropping this year. But that's only due not to the real wage gains, but to the fact that three basic things are taking place. The typical working class family in America has increased its total hours worked, taking on more jobs, several part-time jobs, or in addition to a full-time job, an additional part-time jobs. So people are working 700 hours per year.
More hours per year. The additional total hours worked now is over 700 hours a year. That's additional. That is to say, forget the 8-hour day, brothers and sisters. People are now working 10, 12, 15-hour equivalent days of work to earn a fraction of what they could earn before.
And in addition to this, the income for spending, such as cars, medical expense, education, vacations, have come from refinancing homes, taking out usurious loans with 30% interest and even more, up to 300% interest. In just the past 6 years, more than $3 trillion have been obtained in this manner, that is, further debt. And also, there has been a major increase in credit card debt, $2 trillion more in credit card debt. Consumer debt has risen by approximately $5 trillion since George Bush took office. That's how consumer spending has been artificially propped up to compensate for the lack of real income gains in wages since 1982. Ralph?
And what Jack, our colleague who has been on Taking Aim frequently, has concluded is that the depression will mean fewer hours worked, and given the continuing decline in real weekly earnings for the 90 million, combined with the declining opportunity to finance the current spending out of debt, their spending is now grinding to a halt as a consequence, and the magnitude of a debt-driven consumption is a qualitatively different factor today because the economy has entered into crisis. The general scenario is one of debt-constrained consumers and businesses, the cumulative debt exceeding $10 trillion. This is a crisis that is feeding itself. Working people who have been dependent upon credit and the exorbitant mafia embarrassed interest rates, usury doesn't even begin to describe it, that the credit card companies have imposed. Barack Obama opposed a limit on this credit card debt of 31%. 31% is considered to be a minimum. Barack Obama doesn't want to limit it to that. 31% interest. You talk about the mafia, this corporate ruling class is a mafia.
Ralph, I would like to refer, in the limited time we have left, to an important article that we keep moving over week after week. It was in Reuters on March 23rd. Payday loans exacerbate the housing crisis, because it points out just what you're talking about. And it turns out a payday loan is typically for a few hundred dollars and sometimes more, and it's for a term of 2 weeks. It's pure usury. And it has an interest rate, I thought it was 300%, but actually they are as high as 800%, so that the borrower ends up paying $793 for a $325 loan, according to the Center for Responsible Lending, which has been studying these payday loans. The Union Miles District of Cleveland has been hard hit by a housing crisis, and all the conventional banks have been replaced by these payday lenders. They have brightly painted signs that offer instant cash for a week or two to poor families. Well, what happens when you have an annual percentage rate of 391%, that's excluding fees and penalties, and it goes up even higher to this 800%. Exorbitant cost, payday loans, it has a dark side, because these payday lenders get very aggressive when it comes to getting paid. Ohio, this is very important, where so many jobs have been lost, and you have 1,650 payday lenders in Ohio. This is more than all the McDonald's, Burger King's, and Wendy's fast food franchises put together. Ralph.
Well, Maya, the Wall Street Journal on March 7th published an extraordinary documentation of what are called the Fortunate 400 and the magnitude of the wealth that they control. The richest 400 American taxpayers have amassed such immense wealth. Let me give you some indication of this. 0.3%, brothers and sisters, the 400 super rich, 0.3%. have a hold, a stranglehold on real income and real amassment of wealth within the United States. The increase in the fortunes of the 400 wealthiest taxpayers is what is the Wall Street Journal calls phenomenal. They are absorbing increasing sectors of income and of value and of assets within the United States. In fact, the magnitude of this is that the 1,125 billionaires are worth $4.4 trillion, and that's on reported income. The unreported income is multitudes of that, because they're off balance sheets, they're out of the country. The filthy rich, as Forbes calls them, the filthy rich have a combined net worth official within the United States of $1.4 trillion, and the filthy rich are 0.1%. This is a concentration of wealth that dwarfs that existed at the time of the French Revolution, and social inequality is leading to a drop in U.S. life expectancy. The crisis is deepening, brothers and sisters. We are only beginning to see the magnitude of this assault upon working people. There is no resolution of this within the capitalist framework. Struggle is ahead. Social revolution is on the agenda. Let's call it as it is, brothers and sisters. This system must be transformed, and this ruling class must be overthrown and removed from power.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital, Part 4, The Depth of the Assault on Working People, will be on our website, takingaimradio.com, and also on the WBAI website, wbai.org. This program was recorded April 8, 2007. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. We conclude our series this week. Next week, we're going to have an incredible discussion about the plight of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll be with you next week.